courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand?
You hold my hand!
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Hey, Christopher, it's Joanna Stern. We are on a podcast together every week, and we can't get in touch with you. We've checked Twitter, we've tried your phone, we've tried your Gmail. Get back in touch. We'd like to tape the podcast this week.
Hey, sorry.
Are you going to call in?
Yeah, I'm calling in right now.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
We've got her open.
From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week on the show, what the government is doing to regulate the use of facial recognition technology and all the complicated questions that come up in the process. Later on, I'll talk to Adam Savage, the old Mythbuster himself, about his new book and what it's like to be a maker and tinkerer in the internet age. But first, I want to talk about something that's been gnawing at me for the last couple of weeks. As we've talked about in the show, Facebook and Google both recently had these big developer conferences. That's where they bring thousands of people together to talk about all the big stuff they're working on. And one big thing both Google and Facebook focused on over and over and over was privacy. But it's privacy in this weird way. We were all arguing about this on Twitter last week, too, so I figured we'd bring it here. With me, as always, Joanna Stern and Christopher Mims. Hi, friends.
Hi.
Hello.
Mims, you made it.
Yeah.
It's so exciting that you're here.
Where were you?
Oh, it's a miracle.
Make up a great story and tell us what you were doing.
I was talking to somebody about the future of all of our data, the fate of the internet, and the next Manhattan Project, and we got a little bit carried away.
And like we put it like that, like we forgive you. We forgive you.
Yeah, I mean, now I'm kind of interested. This is you so can now, leave again. We're done here.
Yeah.
But okay, so I want to talk about this because you Christopher were yelling at me about this on Twitter last week, and I've been thinking about it ever since. So can you frame sort of the two sides of this debate? There was these competing op-eds from Mark Zuckerberg in the Journal and Sundar Pichai, Google CEO, in the New York Times. Google and Facebook are talking about privacy, and they're sort of redefining this idea of how you should think about giving these companies your data. But can you sort of explain, Christopher, kind of what the trade-off here is that they're asking for?
Well, it seems like Google wants to give you privacy, just not from Google, which isn't totally unreasonable. I mean, that's sort of the cynical way to frame it. But at the end of the day, we all have a choice between like how functional are our services going to be, you know, that's directly proportional to how much data we want to give up. And then with Facebook, it seems more about their strategic shift to we want to kind of downscale the Facebook experience, if that's the way to put it, where we want it to be more intimate. We want smaller groups. So you're going to be giving up less of yourself in that context and be relating, I guess, in a more authentic way. It was the way that I saw it. But both of these felt like, I'm going to say this wrong, Rorschach. There you go. Because the interpretations that I saw just were down to whatever someone's level of trust of these companies already is. So I would love to hear your takes.
What they said is like everyone saw it differently.
I feel like we're in a really difficult place right now where nobody, that there's such a profound erosion of trust that even when they, I think, try to engage in these acts of public transparency, it sort of inevitably misses the mark because people kind of filter it through a pretty cynical lens.
Yeah, I mean, my take, and David, I kind of feel like you were hinting at this in your intro, like this just felt like a marketing show for both companies. And when you really look at what the changes that were made, I mean, maybe Facebook's going to promote their groups a little bit more and they're going to try to force you to more private messaging, and they've done better encryption and made that default. Maybe Google's released a couple of tools that they say now are not as buried. Maybe they're going to release another tool before the end of the year. But like all of it doesn't seem like some major strategic shift. It just seems like, oh, we should talk about privacy and we're going to market it really well.
Right. Well, and it strikes me as neither company wants less of your data, which I actually thought for a long time would be the pitch of like they would come out and say, here is all the data we are no longer going to collect. And it's actually gone the other way, where they're both coming out and saying, actually, we still want tons of data. We want all of it. We just promise we're going to be more responsible with it, which is what falls to me on such sort of strangely deaf ears. But I've been reading these two op-eds side by side, and it's very funny to me because Sundar's in the New York Times makes this sort of long, compelling case that Google needs your data in order to make its products good. And I feel like that's the trade-off that I keep thinking about, where it's like, okay, if I give Google Maps access to my location all the time, there are creepy outcomes of that, but it also means the traffic data is going to be better for me and for everyone. It means I'm going to get better results when I search for restaurants. It means Maps is going to be better. And it's the same with search. It's the same with lots of different Google products. Whereas Facebook's only case for we need all of your data is people want relevant ads.
Right.
Which just does not work for me. That just does not fly. I don't see that.
Don't you just think they need some sort of like basic
level of human
like therapeutic intervention? Like really, like I feel like what they need is like imago therapy or somebody to just shake them and be like, start making I statements. Like just take responsibility for once. Like it's why do you have to be such an egomaniac?
Yeah, but
it's always about Facebook, damn it.
David, I think exactly what you're saying is that Facebook's just like, here's what we do with your, I mean, they're basically, and that's what again say like it's marketing, like they're explaining their business models, right? Like,
right.
And that was what Sundar, I think, mapped out really well, which is like, we take this information because it makes Google Assistant stronger, but you still have control over all of these things, right? And we're going to make even better controls for you. But at the end of the day, I think, and I was actually having this conversation with Katie Binley yesterday about why we've given Google a bit of a pass in this whole hell-ish nightmare of privacy. And it's exactly as you just described, right? Because your maps are better and you use this as a utility and you know you're giving your location data because you are using Maps versus Facebook when you thought you were giving your location data to check in someplace, but then it turns out like, no, we've just been following you everywhere.
Right. Well, and then I think where that trade stops being fair, I feel like is the question I can't wrap my head all the way around, right? Because it's like, if I am giving you a bunch of my location information in exchange for Maps being great and free and better because of my location information, I think I'm actually okay with that. As long as there aren't ramifications I don't know about, like giving my data to Cambridge Analytica to, you know, give to whoever you want so that they can win elections. But then somewhere down the road from it makes Maps better to it makes the ads better to it's data that is just given to anyone who asks for it in order for a company to have leverage and influence elections and what I see in my newsfeed, that's where it falls apart. But it's like where along this line that stops being a good trade-off feels like the big question that I don't know the answer to. And I wonder if either of you have changed where you feel like it falls in the last few weeks hearing about this.
I mean, I think that there are some surveys that Mark Zuckerberg clearly hasn't read saying that people don't actually enjoy targeted advertising, that they find it creepy. I wish I could include this in the show notes. I got a targeted ad this morning that said, it was a t-shirt on Instagram and it was like, old guys born in June are the best. And like, I had a hammer on it. And I was like,
Wait, it was a talking ad?
No, that's the voice I used in my head.
That's what the shirt said.
The shirt said, old guys born in June are the best. And there was like a samurai on the shirt. It was a black t-shirt. And I was like, this is absolutely the worst. Like, this is the nadir of human civilization today.
But are you born in June?
Yeah. And I am an old guy. So it was like, I was like, well, okay, check and mate. Like, you got me with your targeted ad, but I hate you and I want to set your app on fire. And I just feel like this is a pretty common experience for people. And so Zuckerberg's argument that like, oh, targeted ads are going to help you is just dead on arrival. And I think that the line is if not clear, like it's pretty straightforward. Like you said, David, like Maps is more useful. You're using predictive analytics to pop up the destination I want to go to the moment I open that app. Great. You know, I'll do that. And if you want to also use that to make yourself incrementally more income, That's fine. You know, probably don't talk to me about that because I don't even want to think about it. But, you know, if that is the only, if that's the transaction that I'm making and you want to be explicit about it, in the case of Mark Zuckerberg, it just makes no sense at all.
But yeah. Is that for us as users, is that a transaction worth making? I mean, I feel like, you know, there's this new incognito mode in Maps that's coming out. And like, should that just be the default version of Maps for people?
I mean, yes.
Should we start demanding more privacy from these companies?
Absolutely. I think absolutely it should be the default. And that's another thing I read between the lines in Sundar's thing is like, we're going to give you all these controls. And there were a couple of good pieces written after Google I.O. About, okay, great that there are these controls, but they're super buried and they're really hard to find. So yeah, privacy is a human right that requires a lot of work, right?
Like right.
That should be the headlines for all of
these guys.
Privacy
is a human right, .. if you can find it.
Yes. Oh, good. That's a good headline. Let's write this piece. yeah. But like it's the default, right? Like all of these things are never the default. They're hidden. And this even goes to Apple. I mean, Apple's got a lot of privacy controls that are not all that obvious.
What I still wonder is if it's going to ever change back from like we should trust Facebook and Google to be responsible with our data all the way to we should stop giving our data to Facebook and Google. Because right now they want us to exist in that first place where they're like, give us all your stuff and we'll only do good things with it. And if they can pull that off, that means there's going to be this handful of companies that win enough people's trust that they're going to make even more money because they'll have even more control because they'll have all your data. But if we start demanding more from them, which I don't know how we're going to do unless somebody makes a privacy-focused version of Google Maps that's even better, then I think things are going to have to start to change really fast. But right now, like if Google can convince people to keep using Maps because they think their data is safe there, it's going to work.
Yeah. I mean, and one thing I've been thinking about as we've gone through this, and I sort of even thought it, like this is where Sundar might go with this, but what was the headline of his piece? The
like privacy shouldn't be a luxury good or something
right.
like
and
that.
And so I actually thought we might be going with that as like, we shouldn't have to pay for these things, right? And so I have been thinking lately a little bit about, would we pay $10 a month for Facebook, $10 a month for Instagram if it meant no ads, right? We wouldn't, or maybe ads, maybe there'd still be some drags, but we're not going to be as targeted. So that's, they might not make as much money from it. And a lot of people have put forward this idea and the companies don't like it because they probably won't make half of what they make up for us, like even just a sliver, they make more than that. And I sort of think about it, I'm like, I don't think I would pay $10 for Facebook. It's just not that good of a service to me. Instagram, yeah. Maybe? Like, you know.
I think I would for Google Maps.
I would for Google. No, so, yeah. Right. So then you start to look at the real value of what you get from Google. Would we pay $10 for Gmail? Yes.
Yeah.
Would we pay $10 for Google Maps? Yes. So.
But the problem is a billion and a half people use Google Maps, and surely not all of those people would say yes to that.
Haven't you just exactly articulated Apple's value proposition? You don't pay $10 a month for Apple Maps, let's say, but you pay the Apple hardware premium because they're the privacy company. And then you don't have to use these other services that you feel hinky about.
And that was absolutely the message of that presentation 3-4 weeks ago, right? Every single one of those services, they highlighted not only what you're going to pay, not only what you're going to get, oh, yay, magazines, oh, yay, TV shows, you're going to also get privacy baked in. We're not going to know. We're going to know these things. We're going to, about your preferences. You have control over that. You have control over this.
Yeah. I think actually what we've landed on is when you think about like with Prime, like Amazon's proposition is like, we are going to get you to stay on Prime because we're just going to keep adding more and more little extras. And Apple, it's the same thing, but their extras, you know, they are, some of them are similar to Amazon Prime in terms of like streaming media, but the big one is privacy. It's like, hey, here's your nice little bonus that you get. Don't you feel good about this? Don't you want to remain committed to this ecosystem forever?
Yeah, but Apple Maps sucks. So what am I supposed to do about that?
Yeah, I don't know, man.
So this week, San Francisco became the first city in the United States to ban the use of facial recognition by local agencies through an ordinance that passed, I think, on Tuesday. But it's not the only city considering these laws, and there are likely to be more of them soon. There are lots of ways to explain the trade-offs and debates here, but I really liked this quote from Tony Montoya, who's the president of the San Francisco Police Officers Association. Here's what he said. He said, there must be an appropriate balance between those who subscribe to Orwell's Big Brother mentality and those who want to prevent car break-ins and porch package thieves. Just like it's a perfect framing of the whole thing. Anyway, Tony said that to Asa Fitch, a reporter here in San Francisco. He's going to explain more about the laws being debated and passed and what it all means for us. Asa, thank you. So explain the law that San Francisco just passed.
Okay, well, it's a multi-part law. One part is banning facial recognition by local government departments, including the police.
Like a ban on facial recognition is a big statement. Is it that sort of broadly defined? Anything that is facial recognition is banned.
It's a flat out ban of the use of facial recognition by government departments.
Okay. Not
private businesses, but government departments.
Okay.
Including the police.
Right. Okay. So that's one part. What's the other part?
The other part is the city wants a review, a capability to review any proposed acquisition of surveillance technology by government departments as well. So, you know, if the police department wants to buy a new sensor that detects bullet or, you know, gunshots, they will have to bring that before the Board of Supervisors, which is the legislative body that oversees the city, before they're allowed to purchase that technology.
Okay. That also feels really broad.
It is pretty broad. And part of the reason they say they wanted this law is they wanted a broad kind of say in how departments, buy this technology, what they do with it. Right now, they say that they don't have any even oversight. They have no knowledge, really, of what these departments have currently. And that's troubling to some people or some members of the board.
Okay.
I was just going to ask, what are like some use cases where this, like we now know from this ban, things won't be able to happen? What are things that are just not going to happen now because of this ban?
Okay, sure. Like, police body cams that can recognize people's faces. So, you know, let's say you many years ago had your driver's license picture taken or you were arrested and you had a mugshot. Those now can't be compared to, video that police are taking, mm-hmm. and they can't use that to, find or arrest somebody they're looking for. So that's just one example. I mean, there are many others. You know,
I was wondering was, would schools be one of them?
Like, sure. I mean, schools are...
If it was a public school that wanted to use some form of facial recognition for, you know, making sure people who are entering the school are children and not, I don't know, someone who's a stranger or something like that. Would that apply here or no?
Yeah, that would apply to city schools. I mean, it applies to all city departments. So any, you know, the city education department, the city police department, the city transportation department, all of those departments are kind of subject to this ban on facial recognition and this surveillance review. You know, some people oppose it. You know, they say it's there are beneficial uses of facial recognition, and this goes too far. You know, some people are sort of in the middle. They say, the technology is not perfect. We should put a moratorium on it for a while, but we shouldn't outright ban it because there are some beneficial uses, like potentially the one you described.
So let's back up a little bit here because it seems like. Like I can sort of understand the tension on both sides of this, right? It's like facial recognition would help solve some crimes. That seems probably true. Facial recognition is also like very invasive in lots of ways. That seems also true. But what seems to have been happening so far is that facial recognition is being used in some of these ways that you're describing, but we don't necessarily know that it's like I was reading a lot about this and can't quite figure out. Like it seems like some police departments are using it, some governments are thinking about it, but we don't necessarily know how it's being implemented. Is that true? Like, how much is facial recognition out there in the ways you're describing now?
Yeah, there are a lot of unknowns around it, and police departments and others have just started to use it without asking for permission in many cases. And so, you've seen many states and many cities kind of deciding to harvest the photographs they have from mugshots, other things, and use them to identify suspects. And there really hasn't been a law in many places that would require any disclosure of the acquisition of that technology. And so these departments, in many cases, have not disclosed it. And that, to some people, is, you know, problematic.
So it's one of those basically, like, there's no regulation yet, so we don't even have to talk about it or get permission for it because there's nothing to get permission for because this is all happening so fast, governments haven't even really thought about it yet.
Right. I mean, people, it's what often happens with technology, right? You know, people start using it and at some point concerns are raised about it potentially and then the regulation starts. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find a case where people regulated something before it started to actually happen. And so I think we're kind of in that stage now where this technology is becoming more prevalent and so people are actually starting to see it more and starting to raise questions about it and starting to think about regulating it.
That's also a really hard thing in like where we're headed with this technology is that for this to get better, like any technology has to be used and tested and beta tested. You don't want it to just roll out without that, but how else do you do that when you can't have pilot programs or have, you know, one small office testing something in a limited run?
This ordinance basically prevents departments from doing that. The police actually had tested some of this facial recognition technology. Clearly, this is something the departments do before they adopt a technology. They test it out and see if it's going to work. This prevents that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I suppose that you could see a situation where a company, you know, came forward with some statistics and some, you know, metrics of their own technology and, you know, was able to convince the authorities in San Francisco to roll back this ban so that the, you know, department could buy it. You know, and that's one thing that's one way that proponents of this ban answer the opponents of it who say that there should just be a moratorium. They say that, you know, if there comes a time when facial recognition is viable, they can simply pass another ordinance that would allow it.
Kind of takes the teeth out of a ban,
right,
doesn't it? To say, well, eventually we'll unban it.
What do you think about the critiques that it's silly to ban facial recognition because the real problem is that there is widespread video surveillance and that footage, you can identify all kinds of things in that footage. So like one thing that people don't appreciate is we have AI all over the place that's identifying people's license plates. And, you know, it's like a biometric for cars. You can identify people's, you can identify them by the way that they walk. You know, you could ban facial recognition and just channel all of that energy into other ways to track people.
Right. I think that proponents say facial recognition is just especially pernicious because, you know, you can't hide your face in public. You can't change your face. And in many cases, you don't know that your face exists in some database. You know, it's not like you put your fingerprint down and you know your fingerprints were taken.
Have these people, you know, not seen Mission Impossible?
I was just going to say all
those,
of my references for this
are
Tom Cruise movies.
Yeah, I was like, Ethan Hunt has done all of those things.
Okay, before we get to Adam Savage, it's time for our weekly segment, Today I Learned. Every week, one of us brings some weird thing we discovered that may or may not have anything to do with a story that we're working on. This week, somebody asked me what I learned about my sunglasses this week.
What did you learn, David, about your sunglasses
Thank
this
you.
Week?
That was such a great job, Joanna. So I tested these things called the Bose frames, which look kind of like a normal pair of sunglasses, but are basically also a pair of headphones. And they don't go into your ears, but they create, I think Bose calls it something like a personal sound environment. And I thought there was no way this was going to work. But I've been learning about how Bose is doing this. And it turns out that it's actually working on basically a way to use microphones and speakers to create a sphere of sound and then use the pressure created by the transducers that are putting out the sound to use other speakers to put out opposite pressure and cancel out that sound, which means that it's able to basically say, we're going to have sound in a box about the size of your head that you'll be able to hear. And then anything outside of that box, the audio just simply won't go because it's being canceled out as it leaves that space. And so what that means is these glasses, you put them on and you can hear the audio as if you're wearing headphones, as if it's, you know, a speaker attached to your face. But anybody outside of your little realm can't hear them. And the frames don't work perfectly. It's like, You know how the people wear ear pods on the train and you can hear their music out of their ear pods if you're sitting right next to them? It's kind of the equivalent of that. And it's like a little bit the worst if you're in a quiet place next to somebody. But if you're out in the world, if I even hold the glasses, you know, 2 feet away from my face at arm's length, I can't hear them anymore. And so Bose has this theory that this technology is going to mean they can do things like put speakers into hats or necklaces and create these little sound bubbles around your head so you can hear things without wearing headphones. And the more
why are headphones so terrible? I thought headphones were perfected.
No, headphones are terrible. The problem with headphones is you have to wear them in your ears and you look like an idiot and you can't hear anybody and nobody knows.
So a Bose bowler hat is better?
Yeah, dude.
I'm really looking forward to my Bose necklace.
Tip of the morning Bose to you. Hat. Top of the afternoon, whatever it is.
Would you like my diamond necklace that. From Bose? That's not a diamond, actually. It's a microphone.
Sorry, please continue to try to sell us on this.
Bose, 14 karat microphones.
Call us for marketing ideas.
Yeah, this is all going to work. I think a 14 karat microphone is really a billion-dollar idea waiting to happen. But no, so the idea is basically, what if you got all the upsides of headphones, but A, you could still hear the world, B, you didn't have anything dangling in your ears, and C, you didn't have the social weirdness of people having to talk to you with headphones in, because you would still be able to hear them even if you're listening to your own music at the same time or whatever. So it, to me, it starts to solve a bunch of these sort of weird social problems with wearing headphones all the time, which seems increasingly like what people want to do. I mean, I see...
Except the new social problem is you don't know if somebody's listening to something while they're talking to you, because you no longer have the signal of, oh, at least they have headphones in. Like, I know this is a pretty obvious signal.
Right. Like, it's
right.
If you go order your coffee and you have your AirPods in, they like look at you like you're... Like they're waiting. They're waiting for you.
Like I could be recording this podcast while walking around and just muting myself, having a conversation with somebody and then clicking over. And then like neither side would be the wiser that I'm like half checked out on both counts.
Maybe it's like the headphones need a sign that's like, you know, sort of like a recording sign. Like you can talk to me right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like the Google Glass thing where you could never tell if the camera was recording or not. And so it freaked people out because you just learn to assume everybody's always recording.
Right.
Like the social signals there are just weird. And something that means at least even if I can also hear my podcast, I still can hear you while you ask me what I want at Starbucks. That seems like a victory. And the tech works better than I thought it was. And it's apparently relatively straightforward audio science, at least according to the people at Bose who... It tried to explain it to me about 12 different ways before I started to understand it.
It sounds super cool.
Yeah.
I mean, we should all try it.
Yeah, you should. And they look like sunglasses. They're like kind of big, thick sunglasses, but they kind of look like sunglasses.
Can I just point out that like suddenly our head is becoming a platform that is going to require... we're just going to have to cram a lot in there, because also I thought that my sunglasses were going to be reserved for my AR goggles. So like how much more do we have to stick onto my temples?
I think that they will. Like your AR glasses will have this technology built in.
Yeah, it's going to be both.
You won't have to
because by the time if you're
things,
wearing AR glasses and headphones. Right, exactly. Right. But yeah, I'm down.
Think about it. If you're wearing your shirt that says old guys are born in June plus this, you're going to look awesome.
Oh my God.
We have to buy Mims that t-shirt now, Joanna.
Oh, no.
All right, Mims.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up in just a second, my interview with Adam Savage about how builders and tinkerers made the world we live in and what it means to be one of them as the world becomes more about laptops and code than hammers and nails.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. I first started watching Adam Savage make stuff on Mythbusters, the long-running show where he and co-host Jamie Hyneman built huge flamethrowers and boats made of duct tape and like weirdly impressive ping pong ball cannon. Adam's also been a model and prop maker on movies you've probably seen, like The Matrix Reloaded and Star Wars Episode II. Don't blame him for either of those movies, though. The models are cool. He also has a new TV show coming out later this year called Savage Builds, and he has a new book called Every Tool's a Hammer, Life is What You Make It. The book's all about what it means to be a maker, a creator, a tinkerer. It's full of these big life lessons and really small tips about how to fill in checkboxes. It's a fun read, and I really enjoyed it, but it made me think. In the early days of the computer era, it was makers and builders like Adam who were physically with their hands putting together the tech that now runs the world. But now it feels like everything's so abstract. It's all just in code. So what does being a maker mean when everything's an app now? Earlier this week, I went to Santa Cruz, California, where Adam was having an event for his book release. One thing he talks a lot about in the book is his obsession with recreating props from movies he loved. He's been doing this for decades. And it made me wonder, what was it like to tackle one of those projects before you had the internet?
It was really hard. The first Blade Runner gun that I replicated was in 1986 in New York City. I had gone to see it at one of New York had at that point 5 or 6 or 7 art house theaters that were running, you know, David Lynch film festivals sure. just all the time. And Blade Runner was playing at the Thalia, and we went and saw it. And my buddy David at the time, who was so obsessed with Star Wars, his high school bedroom, he named it Davey's Light and Magic.
That's amazing.
And Davey had made a Blade Runner blaster that wasn't really accurate in terms of any of the surface details, but it had a similar profile, and he built a flash bulb into the end of it. So when you pull the trigger, it went.
Oh, that's good.
And that blew my mind. And so I was living with him at the time in Hell's Kitchen on 50th Street and 8th Avenue. And we grabbed a VHS of Blade Runner, and I literally was freeze framing the VHS tape and making sketches. Wow. That was how I did my research for the shape of the barrel. And I still have that pistol that I built.
It's like quick play, quick pause,
and it's,
new
yeah,
sketch.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay.
You know, you found later on when I re-replicated the Blade Runner blaster, which would at this point be 1995, still no internet to speak of. Mm-hmm. So we had a sort of fan culture store called Heroes World on Clement Street in San Francisco. And they had a Blade Runner blaster, but they had sold out of it. But they had a magazine of a Japanese builder who'd made one exactly perfectly. So I used that reference material and scratch built my second one. Although because I didn't have a size reference, mine was 20% too small.
Okay. Because you're just looking at a picture, like banana for scale or anything
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. Okay. And even today, I am regularly off in my size estimates by usually 20% too small because I haven't accounted for the parallaxing of the camera.
Oh,
and even a 20 degree angle, a couple of inches can make a massive difference in your reference points for the sizes of what you're replicating. Suffice to say, it was really hard. You had to find people who had castings. You had to get, you know, trade information at shows at like Star Trek conventions. You'd run into fellow geeks, comic book stores, zine stores, you know. And I had a network of people. There was a guy I knew who made beautiful lightsabers out of Texas for a pretty reasonable deal. And there was another guy who made, you know, Forbidden Planet guns. But that was like, you found these people through zines and like through other friends and called them up. There was no just emailing them.
And now it's just YouTube. You just go on YouTube and somebody
now
else
it is
has
YouTube.
Tried it.
It's still hard to find information on esoteric stuff.
Okay. Is there any part of that that gets less fun as tech makes it easier?
No.
Okay.
Not at all. Because there's still, okay, I'm replicating Major Kong's survival pack from Dr. Strangelove. That's one of my props. And there's the little 6 pill bottles, which you can see again in the Traveling Kubrick exhibit. Try searching pill bottles on Google. It is the most nightmare signal to noise ratio of
Fair.
One.
Yeah.
So I started dram bottles. I started searching perfume bottles, perfume samples, apothecary, esthetician, scent, everything I could think of anyone who would use this, and struck nothing. Then I ordered some bottles because one of them looked kind of like it. And I ordered some cheap on Etsy, and they came, and I was looking at them. And as I started to do more research, and this was dumb of me not to start this way, I realized that there's a taxonomy of bottles.
Oh.
And that they are taxonomized by different features. And one of the most important features for the taxonomy of a bottle is its lip shape. So then I went looking at bottle lip shapes and realized that the lip size, first of all, I'd figured out that the bottle size was 1 dram.
Okay.
Then I realized that the type of lip was called a patent lip. And when I typed into Google patent lip 1 dram bottle, it was like Rumpelstiltskin. I cracked the spell and I was met with hundreds of pages of the exact bottle I was looking for with the precise top. And it was 0 to 100 with one search term. That I still get the endorphin rush telling that story.
That's pretty cool. So the thing that most resonated me with in the whole book was the stuff about lists. Because I'm so obsessive about lists in the same way that you are. And I have spent, I don't know, the better part of a decade using like every digital tool for list making and stuff I can. And I always wind up back at notebooks. So I wonder, like, are you an app guy at all? Like all the stuff in your books is like sketches and stuff. Like,
I am an app guy. I use Evernote.
Okay.
Jamie and I did some stuff for advertising for Evernote way back when. So we have some equity in the company, and I've been using it ever since. And I really like the fact that it's seamless between my phone and my computer. So I use that for actually a good portion of my lists.
But you're still a pen and paper guy, it seems.
I am a pen and paper guy. I use Google Docs for archiving the costumes in my collection. I have over 70 with every single part, piece, and bit and bob from each costume photographed, allocated, given a serial number, and with all the information about it, where I got it, whether I think it's 100% accurate, whether I might rebuild it someday. All that's in Google Docs. Mm-hmm. So I can, when I'm talking to people who might want to borrow a costume, I can literally send them the link to exactly what they need. But I've always been a pen and paper guy. I love when I have a busy month, even though I use Calendgoo, which is a very dense app for looking at your schedule. I still need often to sketch it out in longhand and just fill in what happened so I really get a physical feel for the layout of days. And when my boys were, I have 20-year-old sons, twin boys, when they were in school and we were signing up for summer camp every summer, that had to be done with pen and paper. There's just no, because you're constantly moving parameters around you. There still is no productivity app that can quite do that to the level of granular attention that I need. But I just was reading something that said every productivity app is competing with you emailing yourself.
That's very true.
Yep. It totally is.
Yeah.
I'll pick up a notebook from 10 years ago, a sketchbook, and I'm like, oh, I don't remember drawing that. Oh, I remember writing that list. And the thing is that it's when I write a list down, partly I'm putting it down to memorialize it so I have it and I can see the shape of whatever I'm listing. I can kind of understand its real, the scope and parameter of it. And the physical act of writing gives me that way more than any digital tool. But also, I'm physically putting it into my body by making my body write it.
Yeah, and it's the act of writing that winds up being the important thing. So that's actually a perfect segue into one of the things that I'm curious about after having read the book. Would young Adam growing up now, instead of building things, would you be learning to code so you could go work for ILM and do special effects?
You know, it's funny that you asked that. I have many friends at ILM who were in the model shop as physical model makers that retrained at ILM to become digital modelers. And to the last, while they admit that it is a little bit less fun than getting your hands dirty, that it activates all the same creative centers.
Really?
I find it just as satisfying.
That's good, because that's one of the things I wondered is like, is that, are we losing something in that?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm loath to say yes. For me, I need the physical contact with the world, but that's how I recapitulate the world is through my hands. A singer is doing that through their voice, and a filmmaker is doing it through at the editing bay. And, you know, each of these, we don't choose these mediums, they choose us. And when you have, I mean, one of the great things that the digital age has done is it's lowered the threshold of access to so many more people. You don't need Pro Tools to mix some sick beats. You can do it in GarageBand and it's 99.9% as great. You have less control, but you know, again, these tools are being made available to more and more people, which means we see more and more variety. And for me, that's a net good.
And on that same front, 3D printers are one of the things that you touched on a few times in the book, but I kept thinking about it. And I remember, I don't know, 10 years ago, everybody, me included, being sure that 3D printers were going to be in everybody's house. You'd have two of them. They would make all the things that you needed. It would be the greatest sort of tinkerer invention ever. But it doesn't seem like it's gone that way.
What people have learned is that every 3D printer takes a bunch of maintenance. And it's a new technology, which means it was, for the longest time, very spotty, very touch and go. You know, one version of a printer might be great. The next one might be shite. However, what I get excited about is not the idea of 3D printers being replicators. I get thrilled about the idea of a generation of digital natives being able to take this technology and move it out of the realm of rapid prototyping and into the realm of rapid manufacturing. Because I would love nothing more than to buy my next iPhone case from a kid down the street that's built from his point of view to my needs, and we have a relationship. Some of the most fertile and satisfying commerce-based relationships that I get to enjoy are with people that I collaborate with and commission through sites like Etsy or DeviantArt or that I find on Twitter. That to me gets really exciting.
I mean, it just seems like by the time you get to CAD plus 3D printing, it's like on the one hand, you've just simplified monstrously difficult processes into one thing.
In theory, you've simplified, yes.
In theory, that's fair.
And I think really, so it starts with CAD, and CAD still sucks. Like CAD, and
CAD really does suck.
Autodesk is really working hard to lower the threshold of entry to CAD/CAM, and that's vital if this is going to work. Everybody's working on, I mean, the moment Apple put two cameras on their phone, it told me they're working on AR and photogrammetry.
In 10 years, are you going to be building stuff in AR as opposed to in a shop? Like, does it matter to you?
I doubt that. Okay. I prefer the peace of the bench and the noise of the tool. I've toured around the country over the last 7 or 8 years, a bunch with different stage shows. Frequently, I would call them during their dinner, which was me getting out of the show on the East Coast. And my wife would put the laptop on Skype and I would eat dinner in my bus.
Oh, wow.
While my kids and my wife were eating dinner at the dining room table. And I hate talking on the phone. And I hate talking on the phone. I have this whole theory about it that I've never fully elucidated, that it's all about the latency. But when you have body language, when you can see people, it's much more intimate. And that's really impressive. So to me, the idea that I could see my wife sitting on the couch next to me while we chat about the day, that gets me really excited.
Yeah. I mean, and especially for you as someone who seems to love the community aspect. Like, it's very instructive that you started by like building theater sets and that was a part of your sort of formative experience instead of like working in a shop alone. It becomes a thing you do with other people very quickly. And I feel like
that's a really interesting point.
And that to me is the interesting thing about what's happening now, where we're spending so much time sort of sitting at computers and coding. It's like it's just communal in a very different way.
Are getting out. There's more and more small cons moving around the country.
That's true.
There's more and more places for people to go find their folks and to exercise their wonderful, weird freak flag. You're right that theater is a deeply communal and community-oriented exercise. And that's one of the things I really love about it. I like to point out to people that theater is the first art form that will survive an apocalypse completely intact. Like the morning after, whoever's left, 5 or 6 people, they're going to get around a campfire and tell stories.
That's really good.
And that's a form of theater.
Did you ever read the book Station 11?
No.
It's about a theater troupe after the end of the world.
Fascinating.
And it's wonderful. It's a really great book.
Oh, yeah. I would totally be in that.
I highly recommend reading. Yeah, I think that tracks for me. So what, I mean, as you look towards kind of the next, I don't know, phase of technology, like, is there stuff other than what we've talked about that's interesting to you? Like, are you waiting for the Apple Pencil to get really good because it'll make your life easier? Like,
I love the Apple Pencil. I just wish the apps would pick it up. AR is definitely really exciting to me. The lower and lower cost of entry for digital filmmaking tools is thrilling. The fact that you can get a gimbal now for like $20 is astounding. When we started making Mythbusters, there was no GoPros.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Right. Like,
that would have made your life a lot easier.
Just dropping a camera meant that you lost the last 3 seconds because that was the buffer in the DV cams. So it was a complete nightmare. We had to buffer everything. Look, when you ask me about future technologies, I think the one that's going to save the world, right, which is the worst plan in the world, is that the technology is going to save this world when all we need to do is actually stop using the technology that we're using. I love the fact that in Seven Eves, Neal Stephenson he takes you through 5,000 years of future Earth history. And there's this long reset where humanity builds itself back from nearly zero. And once they've built back to some reasonable populace 5,000 years later, they didn't reintroduce smartphones. Even though they had access to all the same technology, they were like, yeah, that didn't work out so well for us the first time. And I'm like, that's Neil editorializing, and I dig it. As I look towards the future and I think about this difficult time, and I'm genuinely scared all the time. That is, like, I'm in abject terror because I think that, you know, we're burning this place from the inside, and it's terrible. And I talk about it using my platform. I donate. I do research. I you know, I'm working towards the good, and I also have to just be doing what I do, which is tell the stories that I want to tell. And you know, the older I get, the more those stories become about passing on the knowledge that you have and building a community around you and keeping that community really strong. If we make it out of this, it's because we built strong communities of people that felt seen and heard and were listening to each other and really understanding each other's experience. Anything else is simply digging a hole that's constantly filling in.
Adam's book, again, is called Every Tool's a Hammer. Life is What You Make It. It's out now. It's great. I really enjoyed it. Anyway, that's our show. Thanks to Adam, Asa, Joanna, and Christopher for being here. Thanks to Becca and Tanya, our producers, and Wilson, our editor. And thank you for listening. We have new episodes on Fridays, so make sure you subscribe to Instant Message anywhere you get your podcasts. And as always, if you have feedback or ideas, email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you soon.